Prisoners have been on strike. There was a call for prisoners to stop working, hold sit-ins, go on hunger strikes, and other actions until a set of 10 demands is met. Joining me now is historian Heather Ann Thompson. She is the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. She's also a professor of history at the University of Michigan. Welcome back to Stateside.
Great to be here again.
Let's get to the basics of this. What has triggered this strike by prisoners?
Well, what we don't realize is that prisoners protest every day, and they've always protested over the same thing, terribly inhumane conditions in prisons across this country. Michigan is no exception. And this time, they decided to do it in concert. They decided to make a national call that went out to every state, and prisoners across this country have stood together during this two-week period to call attention to the terrible conditions that we as taxpayers fund and need to know what's going on.
So we're in the last days of the time period set out for this strike. It's hard to get information, but I'm hoping you have some context or better ones than I have. What have you been hearing about it?
Well, what we know is that there have been many states that have gone out, from New Mexico to California to South Carolina, but it's not a surprise. We don't know more. Prisons are hugely closed to the public, despite the fact they're public institutions, and so we need to rely on folks telling their family members, who in turn tell the media. We have to wait for some time often to know exactly how many people protested. This happened again in 2016 in Michigan, and it took literally months before we understood how many folks had stood together to call attention to these conditions.
Because they have these 10 demands. Can you outline, without going down the whole laundry list, what do they want?
Well, the demands are both very intimate and very general, very policy-oriented. The more intimate demands are to improve the conditions, the direct conditions of confinement that people experience every day. No one's asking to get out. They're asking to simply be treated as human beings inside. So that could be everything from, you know, basic medical care to food to not having abuse in the prison. But then there's also some bigger demands, public demands for sentencing reform. We now have more people in prison than at any moment in U.S. history and more than any other country. So there's a call for us to revisit our sentencing policy and to really think about the racial disproportionality of who's in prison, too. This is a key demand.
I want to talk about that a little more a little later. I've read in several reports that the prisoners are charging their enduring slave labor by the prisons. What do they mean by that?
Well, I don't think that most folks on the outside understand that we do have a provision in our Constitution to keep people in slavery, and that is if they are convicted of a crime. And even though that is constitutional, it is nevertheless immoral in the sense that you're forcing people to labor, but you're not giving them any remuneration that they in turn need to pay for their kids on the outside, to pay for their ability to do well when they get out of prison. So it's literally slave labor. It's exploitative labor where no workers on the outside are getting paid to make those cabinets or those dentures or those ball caps, and no one's getting paid on the inside either. So only state institutions and private companies benefit.
So in a lot of cases, though, these prisoners aren't forced to work. They volunteer to work knowing that they're going to get 13 or 16 cents an hour. So who's problem is it if the prisoners are volunteering for it?
That's a great point. So the key issue is that work is not the problem. No one is complaining about work. Work is actually good for all of us. It gives us time to pass the day, gives us skills, gives value in its own right. The problem is the exploitation. And you're absolutely right. People want to get out of these tiny 6x8 cells to do productive labor, but they wish that they then had enough money that they could, for example, afford extra food to get a more nutritional diet in the prison.
Are prison industries a big moneymaker for some states?
Indeed. I would invite any one of the listeners to go on Michigan's website or any other state website and look up the correctional industries and just click on the catalog. You might be absolutely stunned by the number of products that are made that, even if they're being sold to other state institutions, are oftentimes things that used to be made on the outside and no longer are.
And is that compensation that I talked about a minute ago, pennies on the hour, is that typical? or do they get, does it vary from state to state or from institutions?
Yeah, it totally varies. And the best case scenario are prison jobs that are created under a program called PI. And those are supposed to be a prevailing minimum wage. But once everything is deducted and all these loopholes, basically, no one ever really makes a minimum wage. And in many, many states, you're literally talking about pennies on the dollar and sometimes no pay at all to do very dangerous work. For example, cleaning up after the BP oil spill or fighting fires, California.
Yeah. For a dollar an hour.
Exactly.
One ex-offender said on Democracy Now, on the same program you were on, that, quote, it's kind of like a modern-day plantation situation specifically targeting poor people and most especially the most marginalized community, black and brown and LGBT community, end quote. What can you tell us about a statement like that?
Well, I think it's just the clear recognition that it's not just anyone who's in our prisons. If it were true that those who committed the crime did the time equally and there was equal justice under the law, the prisons would not be so racially disparate. And then when you throw forced labor on top of it, or at least exploited labor, it does start to resemble the plantations of old, where folks have no choice but to do what they're told to do.
So the strike's been going on for, well, we're almost to the end of it. It ends on September 9th. What are various corrections agencies doing? How are they responding to it?
Well, that remains to be seen. Corrections always will tell you that there's nothing going on and there's nothing here to see. But at the end of the day, we know that there is a real crisis brewing in most American prisons. There was a terrible event in South Carolina where folks were killed. We have terrible conditions that guards also know exist. And so right now we're seeing a real tipping point. It'll be interesting to see whether corrections finally realizes that you've got to run these places humanely, or they will continue to explode.
Now, some of these demands can only be met by Congress or state legislatures. The politicians, I'm wondering if they're paying attention to the strike and the prisoners' demands.
Well, I think they are. I mean, I certainly get calls from legislators in addition to journalists to talk about this because legislators want to know, if this is a just system, why is it so fraught with tension and conflict and periodic rebellions, as we're seeing right now? And I do think that there is some goodwill to try to fix this, but we can't fix it until we fully understand the problem, and we can't understand the problem until we shine some light on what these places are really like.
So this was an odd period. It's like 2.5 weeks. It started on August 21st, ends on September 9th. What's significant about those dates?
Well, this shows you, actually, that the folks on the inside are perhaps more aware of history even than some of us on the outside. The dates chosen were very significant. August 21st, when it began, was the date when a prisoner by the name of George Jackson was killed in California. And he was really an icon for prisoner rights. And so when he died on August 21st, that sent a shockwave across prisons back in 1971. And then it ends on August 9th, which was the beginning of the Attica prison uprising of 1971, again, one of the most important prisoner protests in American history. So those dates are symbolic to folks on the inside, for sure.
So in a GQ interview with you, the interviewer Luke Darby wrote that the prisoners striking today warned that prison conditions have gotten so bad that another Attica is ripe to happen. Remind us about Attica. What was the aftermath of that uprising?
Well, I think those are really sage words. Attica happened because the folks inside kept going through the democratic process to ask for basic human rights. They were ignored. Eventually, they erupted to almost 1,300 men in protest, tried to negotiate better conditions. And then the state of New York came in and essentially killed 39 men, hostages and guards, and shot 128 and tortured countless more. And we don't want that. We want to fix these problems before they happen.
Have we seen a simmering like that? I know there was a problem up in the UP at one of the Michigan correction facilities. Are we seeing a little bubbling like that around, or is that constant all the time?
Well, I think it's constant all the time, but there is no question that since 2016, we're seeing an uptick. In Michigan, the Kinross prison, there was an utter explosion in 2016 because of these terrible conditions. As I mentioned, the Lee Correctional Facility in South Carolina, prisoners ended up dying at the hands of other prisoners. There was no administration help. There was no folks there maintaining peace in the facility. And those guys have been locked down since April. This is a tinderbox, and there's no state that's exempt from it.
So are we on the brink of an Attica?
I think so. I very much fear so.
And I guess there's no way to predict how to stop that. We know what they want. In fact, one of the things I found interesting was it's a lot about rehabilitation and a chance for Pell Grants to get some school so when they get out, they've got a future. And the right to vote, which I'm not sure any politician is going to go with, but, you know,
well, the solutions,
it's on the table now, right?
The solutions are easy. We simply need to treat folks on the inside who may have committed a harm the way we would treat our own children if they committed a harm. That is, with grace, with the idea that folks will return to the community and we want them to return better and whole.
You say that, but in so many cases, these are people who have committed really heinous crimes, and people don't understand why we should give them any kind of a break since they've murdered or hurt people.
Well, and I hear that a lot, and I think the response to that is actually not very complicated. There are indeed folks that have committed egregious harms. The majority have not, but there are indeed those folks. And again, I would say that even if you woke up tomorrow and you learned that your child had committed the unthinkable act, the question would be, what would you want to happen next? You would want them to take responsibility. You would want them to make it right. You certainly wouldn't want them to do it again. And the only way that any of that would happen is to have them in a system that made them whole and better and face what happened, not to torture them. I mean, no one would support that. No one would support that kind of abuse if we just bring it a little closer to home.
Heather Ann Thompson is a historian at the University of Michigan, the author of Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy, which was awarded a Pulitzer Prize for History last year. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much. Take care.